Chapter 4. The Adventure of the Radical Candidate. You may picture me driving the car for all it was worth over the moor that shining May morning. I was glancing back over my shoulders at first, but then I was content to keep glancing in the mirror for anyone following me. I was desperately thinking through everything I had read in Scudder's black book. What he told me was a complete pack of lies. His black book was telling a different tale. Instead of thinking that both were lies, I believed what was in the book. The 15th of June was a day of destiny. It was so big that I wasn't even cross with Scudder for lying to me. Hofgaard, Lunéville, Avocado and Pavia were all the names of authorities. Then there were some other names, Ducrosny and Amersfoort. The basic details of the tale were all in the book, and there was a phrase that had been written inside brackets. 39 steps. The last mention of them in the book said, 39 steps. I counted them. High tide, 10:17 p.m. But I didn't know what it meant. The first thing I learned was the plot had nothing to do with war. I was sure that Carolides was the big event. It had been arranged since February 1912. The second thing was that war was going to come as a mighty big surprise to Britain. Carolides' death would drive the Balkans mad. Then Austria would get involved. Russia wouldn't like it. Then Germany would pretend to try and smooth everything over, but really be pouring oil on the waters. Then suddenly, it would be war. While we were talking about goodwill and the good intentions of Germany, our coast would be rigged with mines and submarines would be waiting for every battleship. But it all depended on what would happen on the 15th of June. The French were working on a real alliance with Britain. Not only would Carolides be in London, but so would the French as well, as the men Scudder called Blackstone. When I called them the enemy, I was right. The information that the French were coming to get was going to end up in Blackstone's pockets. My first thought had been to write to the Prime Minister. But the more I thought about it, the more I was convinced it would be useless. Who would believe my story? I didn't have any proof. No, I had to keep going and be ready to act when things got a little dicey. That was not going to be easy because the police of Great Britain were running after me in full cry, and the watchers of Blackstone were silently trying to kill me. I didn't have a clear direction for my journey, but I went east. I used the sun to guide me. I remembered from the map in the atlas that this region was full of coal pits and industrial towns. I looked around as I drove. I couldn't believe that all of this would be gone in a month, and the fields would be full of dead men. I turned off the main road, and then I heard the sound of the aeroplane. It was flying low and close behind me. I drove as fast as I could. I had to get off the road. I heard a horn. A car was coming towards me on the narrow road. I tried to brake, but it was too late. I had to swerve and ended up going through a hedge. I jumped out of the car just before it ended up in a stream. "Are you hurt?" the man from the other car called. "Just a few scratches." "That was my fault. I'm sorry," I replied. "Come with me. I'll help you. You can sleep in my house tonight," he said. The house was only 3 minutes away. It was a large house that looked very comfortable. He took me into the house and gave me new clothes. I went to wash and change. When I came down, there was food waiting for me. "You've got 5 minutes to eat and then we're going out. We have to be at the Masonic Hall by 8 o'clock. We'll have supper when we get back," my host said. I told him my name was Mr. Twisden. He was the Liberal candidate for the area, and there was a meeting that night. He persuaded me to go to the meeting with him. It turned out that his uncle was in the cabinet. I had read some of his speeches in the papers. He was a very clean, decent, and callow young man. As we drove down the road, two policemen stopped us. "Begging your pardon, Sir Harry. We've been told to keep an eye out for a car like yours," the policeman said. "Righto," Sir Harry replied. I silently thanked God for bringing me to safety. After that, Sir Harry didn't speak a word to me. He was concentrating on his speech. His lips kept muttering. His eyes wandered, and for a moment I thought that we were going to have a second accident. I racked my brains for something to say, but my mind was dry as a stone. The next thing I knew was that we had arrived in the Masonic Hall. There were noisy gentlemen who were wearing rosettes in the street who welcomed us. The hall was packed with 500 people. The chairman introduced Sir Harry and myself. I was given the title of a trusted leader of Australian thought. I hoped that the two policemen at the back of the room took note of my title. Then Sir Harry began to talk. I had never heard anything like it. He didn't begin to know how to talk. He had reams of notes that he read, and when he moved from page to the next, he would begin a prolonged stutter. Every so often, he seemed to remember a phrase that he knew by heart, straightened his back, and spoke as though he were Henry Irving himself. He talked about the German menace. He described it as a political trick to cheat the poor out of their rights and end social reform. He was talking about reducing our navy and then sending Germany an ultimatum to do the same or we would knock her down. As he was talking, I thought about the little black book in my pocket. Scudder and his friends cared for peace and reform. Yet, for some reason, I liked the speech. You could see that he was a decent chap. I also felt much better about speaking after him. It didn't matter that I wasn't much of a public speaker. I was 100 times better than Sir Harry. When it was my turn to speak, I told them everything I could remember about Australia, including the Labour Party, emigration, and universal services. Then we made our way home. Sir Harry was in high spirits when the event was over. He praised me for my part in the evening. "You'll have to stop for a day or two. I'll show you some decent fishing," he said. We ate a hot supper that I was in dire need of. Then we went to have a drink in the smoking room. I thought the time had come to tell him the truth. "Listen, Sir Harry, I've got something important to say to you. You're a good person, so I'm going to be frank. Where on earth did you get all those stupid ideas you talked about tonight?" I asked. "Was it as bad as all that?" he asked, as his face fell. "I got most of it out of the progressive magazine and pamphlets that my agent keeps sending me. But don't you think that Germany would ever go to war with us?" he frowned at me. "If you ask me that question in 6 weeks, I won't need to answer. But if you give me your attention for half an hour, I'm going to tell you a story," I said. It was the first time that I had told anyone the truth about the whole tale. Sir Harry sat in his chair and listened. He was weighing the truth of what I said. Telling the whole thing from start to finish gave me some relief. When I had finished, he got up in a very excited state and paced the room. "What was your job in South Africa, Mr. Hanny?" he asked. "I was a mining engineer. I made my money honestly and enjoyed making it," I replied. "It's not a profession that weakens nerves, is it?" he asked. "No, I can prove it if you like," I replied. "I don't want proof. You're not a fool or a murderer. I believe that you're speaking the truth. I'm going to back you up. Now, what can I do?" Sir Harry asked. "First, write to your uncle. I've got to get in touch with the government before the 15th of June," I said. "That won't help you. This is Foreign Office business, and my uncle would have nothing to do with it. I'll write to the Permanent Secretary at the Foreign Office. He's my godfather. Tell me what to write," he said. We wrote out a convincing letter together, full of code and details. When we finished it, Harry lent me his oldest tweed suit and told me everything he could about the layout of the land. Finally, we agreed that if the police came looking for the car, that Sir Harry would show them the car in the stream. If the enemy came to the door, he was going to tell them I caught the South Express train after the meeting at the Masonic Hall. I shaved off my moustache and changed into the tweed suit. Sir Harry gave me a map, and I fell asleep in the armchair in front of the fire. At 2 o'clock, Sir Harry woke me up and led me out into the dark night. He gave me an old bicycle out of the tool shed. He also gave me directions to the hills. We said goodbye, and I pedaled away from the house. The night sky brightened around me, and the mist cleared before the sun. I found myself in a wide green world with glens on every side and a blue horizon before me.